First off, I promise that this will not be a grim show about resolutions. No lecturing, no go to the gym every day, no cut 20% from your expenses, etc. I mean, you should probably do that, but I suspect if we told you that for an hour, you'd just turn this off. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. The thing about resolutions, or New Year's, or starting over, is that they're all infused with both possibility and creativity. And those are the things that it's fun to go into a new year with, to remember that whatever happened before, you get to write your own script now. Come write to us at marketplaceweekend.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We are going to start with resolutions, but as I said, no lecturing here. This is about success. This week, we asked you to tell us about a time you made a resolution and it worked. And so many of you left us voicemails and wrote on Facebook. One that amazed me came from Parth Chauhan. He's 24, lives in Voorhees, New Jersey, outside of Philadelphia. He resolved to save up money and open a business.
In the end of 2013, a few friends of mine and I were talking about, you know, just work and how we miss college, and it'd be nice to get back to working, I guess, on our own terms.
Mm-hmm.
So our New Year's resolution for 2014 was we wanted to save up some money and start a business, you know, maybe a rental property or a convenience store or something like that. And I was studying for the LSATs, and I happened upon a Facebook post about urban farms and indoor farming in Japan, in an area that was devastated by the Fukushima nuclear disaster a few years back.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is something, you know, that's really remarkable, especially given all the news about the droughts in California at the time and, you know, the negative effects of agriculture. And I thought, you know, maybe this is a business we can try and get started in. So we kind of scrapped the plans for a rental property, and we moved to pursue indoor farming.
So what did you do? Like, what are the steps involved?
For us, I mean, none of us come, there's three partners, none of us are coming from a farming background or anything remotely agricultural. And in our efforts to cut costs and save money, we had to do everything from the engineering drawings all the way to the attorneys. We did everything ourselves. So we worked out with our local township, and we were able to place our facility just about 5 weeks ago in November.
Do you know overall about how much money you've put into this operation?
Well, I think more than the money, because of all the savings that we've been able to put in, we've roughly, I would say, before we even got started, we had maybe $40,000 saved up. Costs are only growing at this point, and hopefully as our produce grows, our costs will slowly turn into profit. But so far, it's been fairly manageable for us.
And then what will you do with this stuff once you harvest it?
So right now, our goal, you know, we're all relatively new college grads, and we have Philadelphia, which, you know, has a huge university population right next door. We've been working with a few schools to supply some of their dining halls, and our plan is also to work with local food banks and things in Camden and some of the local areas without much access to fresh produce and work out a system with them as well.
This is an incredible thing to have grown from, you know, a New Year's resolution.
Yeah. I always think back, it's funny that I got lucky that I decided to go on Facebook that one day instead of, you know, working out another logic game on my LSAT. So it worked out really nicely.
Parth Chauhan, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
We got a lot of messages about saving money. But Warren Gray in Atlanta made a resolution to spend it.
So I have quite a few nieces and nephews, 15 on my side, and I really wanted to think of a way that, you know, they could know that I was thinking of them. And so I set the resolution to send them a birthday gift. And so the way I did this was by setting actually alarms on my phone about a week ahead of time, to remind myself that I needed to send something to them. And I would, you know, either look for sales or, you know, other things that reminded me of them and, you know, package it up, send it to them. Actually, one of my favorite things to send would be like when the store would have those big 5-pound things of Reese's peanut butter cups that I could send. It actually fits perfectly in the USPS flat rate box. And send it to them. I'm sure their parents were thrilled. And I didn't do it to, you know, make them feel like I was spending money on them, but I wanted them to feel thought of and valued and loved. And I hope that that's how they felt.
And do you think that doing this, I don't know, has it changed your relationship with them at all?
I do, because instead of just being a gaggle of nieces and nephews that I have, they're more like individuals to me, you know, and I listen to their parents talk about their interests. I listen to them as they talk about their interests more. And so I feel like I know them better as people.
When you think about this next upcoming year, have you got anything that you're thinking about doing?
Well, I'm continuing this past resolution for 2015 to 2016. I have to be honest, my 2015 was really just my side of my nieces and nephews. My wife's side, there are, let's see, 4 plus 2. So there'll be 6 kids. And so I want to adopt those.
That gets you up to 21 people.
Yeah, that's right. But, you know, the thing is, it's not about, you know, spending a ton of money on them, but making them feel good and making them feel valued and helping us connect. So, yeah, I'll continue that next year.
Warren Gray, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thanks for sending us so many great submissions. We're going to play one of the most creative resolutions I have ever heard at the end of the show. So hang tight. And next week, we want to return to the first question we ever asked you. Because now, in 2016, we are really, finally in an election year. So here it comes again. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Rhetorically, we're borrowing from Reagan, but we want to know about your economic life. Write us at marketplaceweekend.org, on Marketplace's Facebook page, or you can call us 1-800-648-5114. And thank you. If you watch or listen to business news, you know a lot of jargon gets tossed around. Sometimes that includes the terms long and short. Long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it. We do that here with news stories. But this week, we're taking inventory of the good and bad to come in the new year. So for their longs and shorts of 2016, we've got senior writer from Bloomberg Businessweek, Sam Grobart, and Marketplace's own Kimberly Adams. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey.
I would like to start with you, Kimberly. Let's think about 2016. What are you long?
I'm going to be optimistic about 2016, and I am long on better benefits. Better benefits, that is, for workers, because I think this trickle-down effect of these cushy benefits that the tech industry has been getting is finally, maybe, going to trickle down a bit further and a bit wider to other industries. And the reason for that is because now that the tech industry is kind of creeping into all of these other industries, like the automotive industry, I think that they're going to have to in order to catch up. I mean, Elon Musk announced this week he's hiring 4,500 new people for Tesla, and they don't even have to have automotive experience.
Wow. I'm a little skeptical it translates to smaller companies who sometimes can't absorb the cost.
Right, that's fair. But these large employers like the automotive industry, they are major employers. And so yeah, that's going to start spreading, I think. Come on, let's be optimistic. 2016.
Sam, you have a nice pivot here if we're talking about tech and cars to talk about what you are long for 2016.
I am long Apple's CarPlay and Google's Android Auto. These are mobile interfaces that are meant to go work on the screens of your car as opposed to the screens of your smartphone. And they would replace the often infuriating, complicated, bulky interfaces that car makers have been pushing on us for the last decade or so.
Well, that, I mean, presumably that requires some shedding on the car makers part of things, doesn't it?
Right now, they're kind of working in parallel. So you have a lot of automakers supporting these new interfaces while also developing their own. And they're kind of hoping that people will prefer the automaker's own design as opposed to a third party. But nobody really believes that's going to happen. We like our smartphones. We usually hate our Bluetooth connections and navigation systems in our cars, and we just as soon have what's in our pocket on our dashboard than something inferior from Detroit or Germany.
And I'm hoping that all of this comes at the same time as more self-driving cars, so that as people are already using their phones and now using them more while driving, we won't all run into each other.
Well, there's this really crazy arms race that's been going on, right? So on the one hand, we have more things to distract us from driving, but now we have all these new systems that try to help us manage the distraction. And eventually, when the cars become fully autonomous, well, then we can do whatever we want.
Like listen to Marketplace Weekend.
That's right.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Kimberly, what are you short?
Okay, this is kind of meta, but I'm short on stuff. I'm short on Americans continuing to buy lots and lots and lots of stuff. Now, we've known for a while that younger workers in particular are moving away from accumulating the same amount of stuff that baby boomers, for example, did. And if you look at apartment therapy or Dwell or any of these sort of modern home design things, it's all about minimalism.
Yeah.
And the parents of these younger workers are having difficulty shedding the loved family heirlooms. And so then you look at this holiday season, and the National Retail Federation is saying that overall for the holiday season, they're expecting a pretty small increase in spending. And then there was a report out from JP Morgan Chase that said older workers, even those with money and retirees who have the cash, are pulling back on their spending as well.
I think it's a pivot to experiences. You see a lot of research now. You see it sometimes on your Facebook feed that it's much
more. We've done this on this show. Yeah.
Yeah. It's much more gratifying.
Experiences are better than things.
Exactly. So you might spend the same amount or even more money, but you may not have any thing to show for it other than your time spent and the memories that you have from the class you took, the trip you took, those sorts of things.
You guys kind of go together actually with your shorts because, Sam, you are short stuff, though it's specific stuff.
I have a very particular thing of stuff, which is I am short Banana Republic for the coming year. Listen.
I've been short Banana Republic for a long time.
Well, you're not alone. And just in the last quarter, their sales were down 12%. In the last month, they were down 15%. And they're finding it very, very difficult to compete against the fast fashion of H&M, Forever 21, and Zara because Banana Republic takes too long. They plan their clothes out almost a year in advance, and that's just too slow for
today's
market.
And now we know the fashion cycle is like 3 months. I mean, it's super compressed.
It's super fast. These other companies have mastered the art of seeing something on the runway and then getting it onto racks within weeks. And what does suffer usually is quality, but people don't seem to really mind. It's almost a disposable idea behind fashion. Even Gap, Banana Republic's parent company, has seen its sales decline. The only bright spot in that company has been Old Navy, and that was modest. So if you're very cheap, it seems to work. But if you're in that middle, it's really tough out there.
Sam Grobart from Bloomberg Businessweek, Kimberly Adams from Marketplace, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Our stories are often dominated by numbers, which is kind of the nature of money. And here at Marketplace, our By the Numbers blog tracks them and posts them every day at marketplace.org. Here's digital producer Tobin Lowe with some of this week's news by the numbers. Tobin?
Thanks, Lizzie. My first number is
1.
You've had to look up, anything in the last week. You may have seen that one cup of coffee, or at least the value of one, is how much Wikipedia wants users to donate to. Well, Wikipedia. The goal? Stay in business. It's a reasonable goal.
62 million.
That's the estimated number of packages the U.S. Postal Service will return post-holiday season. Consider this, though. Between Thanksgiving and Christmas, they shipped about 600 million packages. By comparison, returning that ugly Christmas sweater or decorative candle doesn't seem so bad.
142%.
That's how much Netflix stock grew over the last year, making it the hottest stock of 2015. As Quartz reports, Amazon came in second with a 122% growth. So, did you buy stock in Netflix? You did. What's that? You can't hear me because your money counting machine is too loud? Fair enough. Happy New Year, everyone.
One of the regular things we do here on the show is look into an economic story that you bring to our attention. It's a segment we call Local Money. We got an email from listener Rafiq Fuad in Vancouver, Washington. He asked about a deteriorating bridge that connects Washington State and Oregon across the Columbia River. The bridge has been at the center of political and economic fights over the past few years, and Fuad wanted to know what it's costing the area. We got in touch with John Sepulvedo to answer those questions. He's the host of Weekend Edition at Oregon Public Broadcasting and a friend of the show. Hi, John.
Hi, Lizzie.
Can you describe for listeners what this bridge looks like and what the problems are? I mean, this goes back to what, 1917?
Yeah. So this bridge is, it looks like something that, you know, a giant would have built with an erector set. It's really it's really flimsy. I was just on it this morning before this interview. I was coming back over from Washington. And you have this impending sense of doom while you're on it. And that's no hyperbole because the lanes are so narrow. There's this metal gate roadway that you drive on. So you feel every vibration in the road. And this week, the roads have been frozen in the Portland metro area. And you can see people, even with this gate, like sliding on this bridge. It's really old and it doesn't serve traffic. Before you can even get to this bridge, you have to sit through car hell. It's just hours of just waiting to get on this bridge in the first place because it is so small and it's only three lanes. So I hope that puts a portrait in your listener's mind of what a complete catastrophe this bridge is.
Well, and my understanding is it's not just commuters, but you have trucks and people trying to, you know, move business back and forth between state lines.
Absolutely. This is a huge bridge for commerce. So this bridge was built to take on the ever popular Model T, which was really popular almost 100 years ago, horse and buggy cars. And now it's taking 18-wheeler trucks. Sometimes it's three trailer trucks because in Oregon you can still drive three trailer trucks. So it's an insane amount of traffic that's going on this bridge because it's the main corridor between Portland and Seattle. And people have been saying for a long time this is a public safety hazard. But not only that, it's a commerce problem because it slows down the amount of commerce that's going between the Northwest's two biggest cities.
Okay, so that brings us to the question of why hasn't this thing been replaced? We could throw around numbers forever. $200 million was spent on planning and design of a new bridge. There's been a question of federal funds going back and forth. What happened?
Really, when you look at it, there were three things that happened. The first was that the costs were not accurately told to the taxpayers. So taxpayers bought into this, and for a while, people on both sides in Vancouver, Washington, and Portland were looking forward to this, and they thought that this was something that was doable. But we saw costs go up. $175 million was spent before any construction was done at all, and most of that went to consultants. Hmm. And as news of that came out, that created a lot of distrust. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that we had in Washington people who identified themselves as Tea Partiers. There are Republicans, and Republicans are normally really strong on interstate commerce. If you look at big projects in Georgia,
sure.
Or if you look at big projects in even in California, Republicans have really helped push those along. But here they didn't, and they didn't for two reasons. One was the cost, but the other was that there was a component for light rail, mass transit. And Republicans looked at this and they said, you know what, this is going to make us more dependent on government. You know, essentially people can't be self-determined if they're not taking their own vehicles. On the other side of the equation, people were really upset that there would be any discussion about increasing the roadways, you know, from three lanes to five lanes, because that would encourage more cars to be on the road. So it's really a tale of two cities divided by a river. One, you know, is really kind of this more libertarian bent city in Vancouver, Washington. They live in the suburbs. They want to be able to jump in their car. They don't want to be dependent on government. They don't want to pay higher property taxes. And they frankly don't want people from Portland taking mass transit in. Portland has, when I say that, I mean Portland has a large homeless population. Hmm. And then on the flip of it, you have folks in Portland, which is considered to be a very progressive city, and they're having a really difficult time trying to wrap their heads around why their northern neighbors would want more cars on the road.
So where does that leave us now, besides with terrified commuters trying to get across a really old bridge?
Well, you know, I think I'm the only one that's terrified, Lizzie, because I don't drive it every day. I think that the people who drive it just they get a life insurance policy and they go with it. I think where this leaves is that there's an understanding that there needs to be a bridge on the I-5 corridor. So there's a real question of when is this going to be built? And it was funny. You know, I was talking to folks about it and I was saying, hey, is there any chance that, you know, the Columbia crossing might be built again? And they were like, yeah, there's a chance of it. But they were talking about it the way that people around here will acknowledge there's a chance of Bigfoot. You know, like, oh, yeah, you know, there might be a Bigfoot, but that's not real. That's not true. That's never going to really happen. There's no desire at this point that I can tell, no real political desire to get it moving outside of the business community.
John Sepulveda, host of Weekend Edition at Oregon Public Broadcasting. Thank you.
Anytime, Lizzie.
Come tell us about the important money stories where you live. Go to marketplaceweekend.org and click on Local Money. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Happy New Year, Ben.
Happy New Year, Lizzie.
Oh.
It's going to be a new year of virtual reality. Get
oh,
ready.
Wow. Look at you. You just set up our segment, which was, hey, what's coming up this year in tech that's going to change our world? So VR is it? Virtual reality?
Virtual reality, Lizzie. Also, a couple other phrases just to put out there. Mixed reality and augmented reality. These are all...
It's my brain every day.
And mine. These are all phrases that are basically related to face-based technology, something you put on your face that either blocks out your environment and adds a totally new environment or adds things to the environment you're already in. And we've got a lot of options coming down the line or already out with these things.
Hit me with them.
Okay, so you've got Samsung Gear VR headset that works with a phone, or it works with a certain number of Samsung phones that you can insert into the headset, costs $100. You've got Sony PlayStation's virtual reality headset that is coming out. It costs a little bit more, a couple $100. Facebook now owns the company Oculus, which makes a much more expensive version of this. And all of these companies have systems out or about to come out, and they're all making content for these systems.
Didn't we have a conversation? I sort of hope we didn't. We're like, yeah, Google Glass is going to be the thing. So how do we make sure that this is not Google Glass again and all of this doesn't, you know, fall on its face?
Well, yeah, this is a really good point, Lizzie. I guess the difference here is I think the technology is really convincing and it's being sold a little bit better. By the companies that are selling it. And the thing that's interesting about virtual reality is it's kind of finally at this place where it's connected to all of these kinds of innovation drivers. Oculus, you may remember, actually started in a lab that was treating soldiers with PTSD.
Wow.
There's always a challenge with content, Lizzie, and that can be really hard to make for these kinds of face-based, virtual, mixed, augmented reality.
Because I guess
systems.
If you have the technology, you got to make stuff you can watch on it, right?
Yeah, you got to make stuff that people actually want to put this stuff on and look really silly with. Another big driver, Lizzie, is going to be business.
How so?
Okay, so I know it sounds crazy, but I went to this recently, this demo that was about an hour and a half. It was put on by Microsoft at their flagship store here in New York. And they call it the mixed reality. Their mixed reality headset is actually kind of amazing.
And it's called HoloLens.
Yep.
And the thing we should say is we're not playing any sound of this for you guys right now because they're keeping this thing under lock and key.
Yes, they are. They're sort of opening it up to developers now because that's a big thing. This is connected to the content part of all of this, that they want people to come and build apps for their HoloLens. So it's not totally under lock and key, but the environment in which they introduce this to people is very controlled.
So what was it like?
Even with all of that in mind, Lizzie, I was kind of blown away. You know, it's this headset, you put it on your head, it projects holographic images into the room that you're in. So you would go into a normal room and, you know, you could do several different things. I did three different demos. One of them was almost like, call it like the future of Photoshop. So you could take these holographic images, you could enlarge them, you could paint them, you could rotate them, you could change them. You had this whole toolbox. In this case, I was playing with a fish. And then an X-Wing. And this thing, they appear right in front of you. And it's kind of amazing. The second one I did was a game in which the HoloLens actually scans the room around you and then animates all these robots breaking through the walls. And you have to shoot them with a little controller in your hand. And it was, I have to say, again, kind of amazing. And the last was almost like the future of PowerPoint, where they took this watch and exploded it into its different parts or separated it into this like kind of really interesting interactive display.
That's where I could see marketers, businesses, big yep. companies using this. And after all, big companies have deep pockets.
Yep, absolutely. And just like you've seen a lot of tablet makers focus on building tablets for the business world and the enterprise world, you are seeing these virtual reality companies do the exact same thing in building content, in building applications for business. And I think that's going to be big in 2016.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Perhaps you're resolving to practice the piano this year, something I have failed at many, many times. Or you want to learn how to play. It turns out that while the West may not be practicing scales in the same way it used to, China is. From our colleagues at the BBC, Mike Johnson has this story of pianos and the people who love them all over the world.
This is an upright Cavendish.
Meet a man who loves his work.
The Cavendish sound is characterized by a mellow warmth. The sound seems to sort of grow, really. That's what we're looking for.
Piano maker Adam Cox puts one of his latest creations through its paces. His workshop is in the rolling hills of the Yorkshire Dales in northern England. His company is called Cavendish Pianos. It's now Britain's only commercial piano maker. Each of his labours of love takes around 3 weeks to build by hand and can cost up to $25,000.
There's various pianos in states of being made. In this particular piano, you can see that all the hammers are in place. All the dampers are in place. It's yet to have its keyboard, so it doesn't look much like a piano. Adam here is making the case parts. Over here in this part of the workshop, we've got a strung back. You can hear the soundboard. The strings. So this has all been strung up. The soundboard's been made, the bridges put on, and the frame put in place. This is our boudoir grand.
You can see all the insides of it. You can see the hammers. You can see the strings. A rather beautiful instrument. Have you got a customer for this yet?
This is going to Beijing.
Are you seeing quite an interest from China at the moment?
It's a very buoyant market. It's one of the few places where pianos are just becoming more and more popular.
In fact, more pianos are now sold in China than anywhere else in the world.
There's been a change in Chinese culture. It used to be said, don't bother playing an instrument, it's a waste of time, you need to learn your science and your mathematics. Nowadays, the teaching of music in China, well, they are setting an example to the rest of the world.
Exports of pianos from Europe to China are growing strongly, which is odd considering China is now also home to the world's biggest piano manufacturing industry. Adam Cox says more Chinese buyers are preferring the mellower sound of many European models.
This piece was the first classical music that touched me.
But as I discovered at one of the UK's biggest piano retailers, looks are important too.
Music is another form of expression. It's like language.
Wenbin Wu is sales manager at Besbrode Pianos. That's a retailer with four floors of mainly 18th and 19th century pianos in a converted woolen mill in the northern English city of Leeds.
Hey, Liu Zong, 你好. Originally
from Gansu province in northwest China, Wenbin came to Britain 5 years ago to study business. His job is to work the office phones hard to attract more Chinese buyers. Wenbin's company now ships 500 pianos a year to China. That's 80% of its overall sales. Many of them are works of art, featuring handcrafted decoration on high-quality woods, including walnut and mahogany.
This is a piano we just sold to China, to a private customer in Beijing. It's a grand piano made in about 1870. It has burr walnut case with a lot of beautiful carvings.
So is it the history of this piano that the Chinese buyer would be interested in, or the look of it, the appearance? There's some beautiful carvings here of some instruments, of a cello, a lute there. It's a lovely piece of furniture.
Yes. In China, pianos look almost the same. They all look like modern pianos, what people can buy everywhere in the world. We don't have antique pianos with color, carvings, even some pianos have paintings on. Europe has a shining history of art. A lot of people, they want to buy a piece of art instead of simply a musical instrument.
Can we hear how it sounds?
More than 40 million Chinese children are now said to be learning to play the piano.
And here building. In fact, he's on the platform.
Many have been inspired by the global success of Lang Lang, China's most famous pianist, now a huge international star. He's given recitals across the globe, from London's Royal Albert Hall to the White House. The emergence of a new generation of piano lovers in the world's most populous nation is certainly music to the ears of piano maker Adam Cox, back where he's most happy, behind the keyboard in his workshop in the Yorkshire Dales.
The number of pianos being exported from Europe to China is going up exponentially, and it's wonderful to be a part of that. Wood, metal, felt, you know, they're all natural materials. You're taking these elemental parts and you're blending them together in a very, very special way to make music. We're making something that, in some small way, makes the world a better place.
That's the BBC's Mike Johnson. Now it's time for the Marketplace Quiz, in which we ask celebrities revealing questions about the money in their lives. Well, sometimes it's more like we ask them to ask themselves. But anyway, if there are any kids listening, you should know there's some light saltiness ahead. And our guest this week...
Hi, my name's Dave Ross, and I'm a comedian. Nice to meet you. In a next life, what would your career be? Comedian, dude. I chose wisely. Or I would sell drugs, I think. Seems like you would make a lot of money, and then it's easy, and also you have drugs. What is the hardest part about your job that no one knows? Oh, well, if I really were to get into this question, it would take hours, and it would be upsetting. Because the thing about being a comic, I don't think no one knows this, because every single person in the entire world is a comedian now, including you listening, and the person next to you, and all the people you know who aren't a comedian are gonna start soon. It's pretty annoying. But, I mean, the thing that a lot of people, I don't think, consider about live performing as a career or as a consistent thing to do is how taxing it is on you emotionally. That sounds like a champagne problems thing to say, but it's really not. Because you're performing, you're trying to impress the crowd. You're trying to get a good response out of them. You're trying to entertain them and make them happy. And so if you do that well and they respond positively to you, that feels amazing. And then the next time, the most talented comedian in the world bombs sometimes. And that feeling is always bad. Because even if you have years and years of validation of people responding well to you and telling you that you're great, standing in a room with people in it who don't think you're funny and actively tell you so feels bad. That's a group of people that doesn't like you. And so the ups and downs of it really test you emotionally. And also you're surrounded by other comedians and you want success and they want success and they're your friends and you're not really competing with them because there's not a limited amount of spots, but you want what each other have. And so it just tests you emotionally in ways that a lot of other things don't. So yeah, don't be a comedian. Any of you. No, seriously, start though. It's fun. When did you realize comedy could be a career? Honestly, 1 or 2 weeks ago. And I'm still kind of questioning it. What is your most prized possession? Oh, man, my cat, dude. My cat. I own that cat. It's mine. You can't take it from me. And I think that's funny. I think about that sometimes, how I own a thing. Like, it's alive and I own it. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense. It was born and now I own it. That's crazy. That's like very close to upsetting. And I'll bet you that there will be a time in history where that is looked upon as like appalling. What was your first job? I worked at Burger King when I was 16. It was perfectly fine. I didn't hate it and I didn't love it. And what was great was that there were lifers there who, there was one dude who loved Burger King. And every day I would come in and he'd be like, dude, did you hear the Whopper Jr.'s coming back? And he was the best part of my day every day. Because it was like, oh, man, like, people always talk about, like, just if you do something you love, then you won't work a day in your life. And that dude found it, man, and it was Burger King. I wish I were him. If money was no object, what's the first thing you would spend it on for yourself? I don't know. If I had the most money, I would buy, like, I might buy like a nuclear weapon. How cool would it be as a person to require proliferation? That's like funny. That would maybe make me the greatest comedian of all time.
Talking about the new year as a time to start over, to make big changes, and that's what the state of California is doing. This month, the California Fair Pay Act goes into effect. It's one of the most aggressive laws in the country aimed at the gender wage gap. This means changes for industries and companies, big or small, including Hollywood. And to tell us more, we've got Marketplace's entertainment correspondent, Adrian Hill. Hi, Adrian.
Hey, Lizzie.
So how does the California Fair Pay Act work, and how is it different than what laws are on the books now?
Like you said, people are calling this the toughest, strictest equal pay law in the country. And it does a couple things. One, it requires that male and female workers doing substantially similar work be paid the same, regardless of job titles or where they work. And the idea there is that's decidedly broader than the equal work standard the law is replacing. So the difference there is substantially similar to equal. The other thing written into the law is there's an anti-retaliation clause. So that means I can walk around the office and ask other employees, my coworkers, what they're getting paid, and I can talk about it, and I can talk about it with you. And the boss can't do anything about that. I have the right to talk about my salary and talk about my coworker salaries. The third important piece of this is the law says that wage differences have to be directly attributable to something like seniority or education, earning, like how much you earn, some provable data. You can't just say, well, we pay him more because, yeah. No, you've got to point to something. Employers have to point to something to tell people why somebody's making a higher wage than somebody else.
And who does this apply to?
Employees in California pretty much across the board. So the law includes public and private organizations, big and small. There aren't a lot of exemptions here.
We have talked before about Hollywood and gender bias. Could this change things in the entertainment industry?
In the entertainment industry, yes. But as far as actors and actresses go, it's an interesting question. You might remember the Sony hack when Jennifer Lawrence, it came out, was paid 7% of the profits from American Hustle and Bradley Cooper got 9%. Uh-huh. Or maybe Patricia Arquette's Oscar speech when she won for Best Supporting Actress in 2015 for Boyhood.
To every woman who gave birth, to every taxpayer and citizen of this nation, we have fought for everybody else's equal rights. It's our time to have wage equality once and for all, and equal rights for women in the United States of America.
So equal wages, I mean, this has been a cause that Hollywood women have really stepped out in front of this year and gotten some attention for. But whether or not this law means that Jennifer Lawrence is going to get paid more, whether it means she's going to get paid the same as Bradley Cooper, that's not quite as easy to answer.
Well, why?
Well, for one, the rates that Hollywood stars get paid, you know, it's a negotiation between agents and studios. So lawyers think maybe the way these negotiations play out will be a little more data driven, a little more scientific. They might look at box office receipts and awards. But also a lot of these big stars, as I understand it, have set up their own corporations. So the corporations make the deal with the studios. The star is then an employee of their corporation. So it gets dicey here. It's tricky. I asked this question to Noreen Farrell. She's the executive director of Equal Rights Advocates, which helped get the law passed. And this is what she told me.
I think this law was really buoyed by the fact that the Hollywood scandals, the Sony Pictures scandals, exposed very large pay differentials. So to the extent that Hollywood was a catalyst to really buoy support for this bill, it's going to get the credit. I think the real impact will be, and not necessarily the Hollywood star salaries, but all the other people that work in supporting the Hollywood industry, from, you know, executives to film crews to sound crews. This is the kind of law that will really make an impact throughout the industry, not just at the top.
And I guess, okay, you look at this law for people who are already in the workplace, but if you're talking about an industry, Hollywood or tech or others, where women are underrepresented overall, it doesn't really help get them in the pipeline, does it?
No, it doesn't. And exactly. So there's this interesting fight for equality that's happening on two fronts that Hollywood is in some ways at the center of. You've got to pay women fairly, which this law will help address. But you've also got to hire them in the first place. And Lizzie, you and I talked earlier in the year and had an interview with Catherine Hardwicke, the director of Twilight, among other things. And she talked about how hard it is for women as directors to get work in Hollywood. The feds are actually investigating that. So while this law is going to help women in some way and help make sure that they're getting paid for doing substantially similar work to the work men are doing, it's not going to get them in the door. And that's another fight that's still getting fought.
Marketplace's Adrienne Hill, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Is there any part of your upcoming year, or even current weekend, that might sound like this?
I only want winners out on the field. Who's a winner? I said, who's a winner? Everyone's hand should be up.
I am.
Okay, everyone bring it in. All right, let's break someone's clavicle on three. One, two, three, break someone's clavicle! Hit the field. Let's go.
That is Will Ferrell in the movie Kicking and Screaming about, I guess we can say, the mania of children's sports. And those sports are now big moneymakers. Lee Eagle is studying kids' sports. He's the co-director of NYU's Sports and Society program. Welcome back.
Hi, good to be back.
Let's start with kind of the universe of youth sports overall. Little League, Pee Wee football, school teams. This used to be a fairly simple ecosystem, you know, nonprofit teams, et cetera. How has that changed over the years?
Yeah, youth sports has really gone from something that we could say was based in the community, pretty local in a lot of different ways, into a business.
Can you give me some examples of this pay-to-play industry that's grown up?
In order to participate, you've got to pay a certain amount, and it's not just the few dollars that it used to be to join the community league. We're talking into the thousands of dollars, and you're looking also at really some interesting levels of obsession here in terms of what people are willing to do and where they're willing to travel. And there's a real part of the business that involves facilities and facilities that are created and established in a lot of cases simply because there's a willingness of parents, children, and families to go traveling around to these facilities from tournament to tournament.
Is that because a parent hopes, gee, my kid might make it big and that'll pay off down the road?
When we ask parents about this, and coaches also, the thinking is generally along the same lines, that it's really all with good intention. And for the most part, it is. But then something happens when the game goes live or even when practice goes live. The more that we're learning about it, really is much more about parents wanting something more for their kids. And I think that's really at the heart of it. But we can't discount the massive amounts of money that are sloshing around sports these days. And so it's everything from a college scholarship and dreams about that to dreams about multi-millions of dollars in a pro contract.
But not that many kids can actually make it to that point, can they?
The percentages are unbelievably small.
Take me through how parents and kids sort of chase this stuff. Because when I was little, you maybe played a sport every season, and the idea was kind of being well-rounded.
And so this is one of the biggest shifts, a really dramatic shift, and probably you'd call it like a generational trend, it seems like, into the specialization of sports. And now we're seeing more and more children hooking into one sport and playing that one sport all the way through. And in some cases, it works out, and they become superstar athletes and achieve some level, but too many of them, and in most cases, are washing out of sports. They're just not getting the experience that you just mentioned having or that I experienced. And the thinking behind it is pretty clear. It is if you have somebody who can focus on one thing and focus on only that, then there's a good chance that they'll profit from it. It's sort of that 10,000-hour rule, 10 years, 10,000-hour rule that well, the research doesn't really hold up on that either. But, you know, we have these dreams. We have these examples. Tiger Woods, when he was 6 months old, was sitting in a high chair watching his father hit golf balls. And it's tough for parents to look at an example like that and think, you know what, I can sit my kid in a high chair at 6 months old and, well, maybe there's a chance. So we're seeing that, and it's actually creating a lot of problems because what we're seeing now are things like injuries, physical injuries, and certainly ones also psychological in kids who are playing one sport. It's just too much.
So if you're listening to this conversation and you have a child in the back of the car, what would you, someone who studies this, tell a parent?
Let your kid be a kid. We don't let children be children. Think about a five-year-old at a hockey practice, for example. A five-year-old can't do the drills that an adult can do. So if a coach comes in and says, well, here are the drills I saw the pro team doing. Kids should be doing that. You know, five-year-olds need to be running around playing tag or kicking a ball. And we don't see that often enough. It's now much more structured, much more organized, and probably not doing as much good as people would think.
Lee Eagle, co-director of NYU Sports and Society, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. It's always great to be with you.
Earlier in the show, we heard some New Year's resolutions, and we're ending today with one that came to us on Facebook. Let's say you're a runner, and pretty often this song comes up on your iPod. That happened to Sarah Jacobs a couple years ago, so she decided for New Year's to research all the things from Billy Joel's We Didn't Start the Fire. Harry Truman, Doris Day, Red China.
Johnny Ray. I did not know who he was. And as a musician, I should have because he was a singer. Probably not the kind of music that I normally listen to, but now I know who Johnny Ray is. And I know I probably won't put him on my iPod. But the very first thing, Harry Truman. I live in Kansas City, but I had never visited the Truman Library. So I decided that now's the time to go. So I went and I had a very specific thing that I wanted to learn about Harry Truman. I already knew quite a bit about him, but I had never heard a recording of him playing the piano. And I'm a musician, so I wanted to hear that. And that was the first thing I asked the museum guard, is there a recording in existence of him playing the piano? And there was. So I was able to watch that video, and it was Chopin. He did a good job. I think one of the reasons that the resolution was successful for me was that I didn't require myself to retain everything that I learned. So as long as I learned something, I could forget it right away if I wanted to. There were times that I got bogged down and I didn't really feel like looking into this. The subject didn't interest me very much. I think that it was a little bit heavy on the sports. I'm not that much into boxing, but there are several references to boxing. And I didn't really feel like looking up these things and learning about boxers, but it made me a better person. Harry Truman, Doris Day, Red China, Johnny Ray, South Pacific, Walter Winchell, Joe DiMaggio, Joe McCarthy, Richard Nixon, Studebaker, television, North Korea, South Korea, Marilyn Monroe. And that's our show for this week. Next week, we're kicking off the election year with the first question we ever asked you. Are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? Why or why not? Come tell us about your economic life. You can go to our website, marketplaceweekend.org, chat with us on Marketplace's Facebook page, or call 1-800-648-5114. Your voice might be featured on the air. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman, Raghu Manavalan, and Shayna Deloria. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer, and Chris Clark is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary.
Thanks for listening. This is APM.